What's up, everyone? Welcome to The Monitor. It is Wednesday, August the 5th, 2015. Happy belated birthday to President Barack Obama.
And to Carly Kloss.
And to
Jordan Dunn.
That is a lot of birthdays of people, most of whom I have heard.
They're within about, like, just like a week of each other. So
I don't know what a Jordan Dunn is, but I wish them a happy birthday.
You should know what a Jordan Dunn is.
If they're anything like Jordan Peele, then they're wonderful.
I think Jordan Dunn is the first black Burberry model, contract model.
Yeah. I don't know models.
Yeah.
And a single mother.
Yes.
And I believe newly 23.
Well, happy birthday to you, Jordan Dunn.
Yes.
You sound fantastic.
Yes.
Like a superwoman, balancing family and work, especially in a field that is so dehumanizing and can spit out its ingenues. So
it's true.
That is true.
Props to you. I hope this 24th year of your life is as glorious as the 19th through 23rd. I'm just guessing how those were. Mm. I'm Peter Rubin.
Yep.
Senior editor at Wired, surrounded by my family in entertainment veracity. That's with an O, not an E.
I suppose I've already introduced myself for the day, but in case
in
case you were surprised, it's Jordan Cruciola, entertainment and research, coming at you with the birth dates.
And I am Angela Watercutters, senior associate editor for entertainment, and also a Leo with all those fine people.
Yeah.
That
you're
name. And happy
Angela Watercutter birthday coming up soon.
I was going to say, it's a little early yet, but soon it will be.
I got to celebrate my Leos because
that's right.
Yep, they're wonderful people. Hi, Dad, also a Leo.
Okay. No worries. I'm Kevin McFarland, writer for entertainment, but my True Detective name is Knox McGillicuddy.
Is there
Knox
a generator?
There should be.
Knox is good.
But going off of the Seth Meyers skit, figured everybody should have their True Detective name.
But what's the system?
I don't know. Just like it's
probably
it sounds
as
dark.
Much as Nick Pizzolatto thinks of it, which is like, you look like a Butch McVig.
I think I just wanted to be Nicky Pizzolatto.
Yeah.
That's good. That also sounds
Nicky
like
Pizzolatto.
Yeah, it sounds like if my cousin Vinny comes back with a sequel, Marissa Tomei's like heir to the throne would be Nicky Pizzolatto.
Mm-hmm.
She knows the difference between a 63 Pontiac Sunbird and another car that probably didn't exist as soon as I say it, and I will be told as such by the many gearheads who listen to this podcast.
Scott Meslow at the Week was doing a like tweet series when the season premiered of a True Detective name generator, where he came up with a giant list of great True Detective names. So that's a good one. Things like Rainwater Clark, Lewin Fandango.
Lewin Fandango.
Vince Vaughn.
I'm glad that in this era of password diversification, we don't rely on one password that we use in every site because we know
because
the vulnerabilities. Nor do we rely on one nickname. We don't keep just our Wu-Tang name or our porn star name and let that stand in for who we are. Why not add a new one to the mix? Have an arsenal. Have a quiver of alter egos, I say.
The Jersey Shore name generator was a little lackluster, but the fact that the button for generating it just said fist pump puts it above most other name generators for me. Oh, and it was the Pontiac Tempest. It looked like the Pontiac Tempest that just jumped into my mind.
In my cousin Vinny?
Yeah.
The fact that, I mean, I just made up a car. Mm-hmm. I did not remember that it was a Pontiac.
But I'm glad we got the Marissa Tomei shout out.
Yeah. Hell yeah.
Yep.
That had to do with steering differential and, the tire.
Tire tread.
I am so excited that she's going to be on Empire, guys.
She's
a muse of mine. I don't know what creative activity she inspires, so she's not exactly a muse as much as I've been in love with her since I was a wee tot, since I was a wee Scotty Lang. Speaking of, Ant-Man manages to hold on for number 3 at the box office.
Hey, go Scotty Lang.
Does that put it above or below Vacation? I haven't checked the numbers.
Barely below.
Ooh.
If you want to talk about something tiny and microscopic, you could talk about Vacation's domestic gross this past weekend, which clocked in at just south of $15 million, or like
40
less,
million away from the next movie.
Yeah, less than Draymond Green's new annual salary.
really, it's really when bad movies happen to good people. There it is.
Yeah. There are some good franchises.
Some good people.
I was going to say, I know we have some Peter.
You know what I didn't know? You had mentioned the horrible bosses, Kevin. You had mentioned the horrible bosses screenwriters. Oh. And I had forgotten that John Francis Daley is part of that partnership. John Francis Daley, who played, the little dude on Freaks and Geeks.
He's all grown up and
writing movies, obviously, and doing well at it. And he also co-wrote Vacation.
He's having his Danny Strong moment.
He is having his Danny Strong moment with arguably much less commercial success. Horrible Bosses was big.
I was optimistic about Vacation until I realized it was written by the Horrible Bosses people. And then everything seems to have followed in suit after that.
Sam was his name on
Facebook. Oh, yeah, that's right.
Isn't he writing the new Spider-Man? I think he's writing the new Spider-Man.
I think his partner is, but are they both together?
I think it's both.
Oh, well, good on you, Sam.
Wow. Well.
I'll always remember you in that disco pantsuit that you bought from Joel Hodgson because you wanted to wear it to the dance. That's a fine moment, and I know you don't like me bringing it up. But screw it. You're not going to listen to this anyway. Nobody does.
I look forward to that letter.
The consumer treasures it.
Indeed.
Yeah.
So I read something about Vacation on Monday as I was devouring the many postmortems with the schadenfreude of 1,000 German copywriters. Mm-hmm. And someone had said that at CinemaCon? I'm going to get this wrong. One of those things that brings theatrical distributors together to see early footage of things.
Oh.
Yeah.
So they played, apparently, at this spring, I think, they played kind of a sizzle reel from Vacation. And apparently, the place was just erupting in riotous laughter. And everyone was like, oh, this is going to be a sleeper hit, but it's going to be big.
Yeah,
and
they just put a great reel together.
They put a great reel together, but as people saw the whole thing, and they realized the reliance on sophomoric,
those kind of gags are good for like 2 minutes, not for 2 hours.
Blue humor, I'd be fine with. It was predominantly brown, from what I understand, was a lot. People were like, "Really, this is a comedy?"
Right.
It just sounded kind of horrific, but no one went to see it. It's not even that people went and saw it and then were mad about it. No one went to see it.
2 weeks of no one went to see it.
Yeah, well, people did go to see movies. People certainly went to see Mission Impossible.
But I mean just like, you know, two things that had a lot of like, really a lot of hope behind them and a lot of resources.
Yeah.
A lot of resources. Yeah, the machine was in full swing behind Pixel, certainly. Yeah.
So what has this summer taught us about nostalgia? Like, Jurassic Park works.
Uh-huh.
But maybe not Vacation movies or things with video games. I mean, I don't know if there's like a narrative or a through line about like what.
I don't know.
Because they're all from a similar-ish era.
I think adding dinosaurs into the equation honestly changes everything.
I think some of it also had to do with Chris Pratt, honestly. He sold a movie in a way that Adam Sandler, as we talked about last week, did the opposite. Like he doesn't not sell movies. He poisoned movies to a degree.
At this point.
And then Vacation, I don't think people understood if it was a remake or a reboot or what the idea was. And then when they found out the deal, it sounded really ham-fisted. And,
and it's so out of step. Like, National Lampoon's has been completely, like, non-existent as a comedy
brand. It's not a brand.
Right,
people.
Yeah.
It was decades ago, but then it sort of, it went away and American Pie had that sort of weird, like, direct-to-DVD sort of monopoly on that weird sophomoric humor, but it kind of, I would say, thankfully, has kind of gone to the wayside.
I mean, the thing about National Lampoon is it was sophomoric at times, but that was not its bread and butter.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it was a PG franchise. It was funny, and it was, like, it got bawdy, but, like, Animal House had its moments, but, like, National Lampoon was about being subversive and fuck the establishment, and like that brand of comedy was as iconoclastic as it got in the 70s. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Certainly, I mean,
it was
the
National Lampoon.
It was it lampooned our very nation.
One would say.
And now it's just National Lamp shade on the head of the party.
Well, now the lampoon that we like is stuff like The Daily Show, is stuff like what Stephen Colbert does.
Yeah.
The Lampoon, they're more just like, it's more like a blow dart.
Yeah.
Blowgun spitting tiny, sharp darts at strategic points. It's death by a thousand cuts instead of...
And it also
seems like the national preference isn't like necessarily the broad sweeping kind of send up.
Yeah.
And also there are kind of multiple comedy empires going on, mm-hmm. too, or families, mm-hmm. or whatever you want, like...
Yeah, like the Apatow
crew, and then the state crew. I mean, mm-hmm. it all blends together at some point, but... And we'll get into that in a little while, certainly.
Yeah.
So, talking about Wet Hot, but yeah.
Mission Impossible ruled the weekend. I guess that's somewhat... Like, it's a 20-year-old franchise now.
Yeah.
But, mm-hmm. like...
Well,
but
as
has
a movie.
But it has continued... Like over that 20 years, 5 films in 20 years, but is there? I don't think there's any nostalgia.
No, really. People are just like, holy shit, Tom Cruise is an action star.
Well, yeah, because, Tom Cruise is an action star.
Because they traded directors out every film, right? Like it's McCoy's Tom Cruise's producer, but no, McCoy didn't do it. He wrote the last one, I think, maybe.
Okay.
It goes De Palma, Wu, Abrams,
De Palma, my God,
McCoy.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Brian De Palma directed a movie in recent history. Can you believe that?
Yeah.
Sorry, go on. So it was him, then Wu, then Bird.
Abrams,
then Bird, then Rock.
And like all of those movies are very distinct. Different, and
also,
yet still
you can just
tied together.
Walk
by
in at any time.
Yeah,
like,
absolutely.
It doesn't. Every one of those things can be a standalone. If you just like some, they have innovative action in Mission mm-hmm. Impossible movies,
and just sort of riding the wave of like what is compelling action movie for what time they're at.
Whoever's overseeing that just has a really good
sense. That's Tom Cruise producer.
Yeah.
That was the first movie he ever produced was Mission Impossible.
And that's that's one thing that I love about the franchise is Bond feels like it just lumbered into the present day with such difficulty. And I feel like the modern ones, I don't have the affection for them that a lot of people do. They feel kind of...
Not even Casino Royale. I feel like that was kind of it seemed like Quantum of Solace was kind of a departure point for people, but they love Casino Royale. You didn't dig Skyfall either or anything like that?
They're fine to me.
Okay.
I mean,
do you like the cheekier Bond?
I like a cheekier Bond, and I like a Bond that is, I mean, it's such a Cold War concept.
Sure.
And I get why they're still going.
Yeah.
You know, it's an iconic character, but it's a character that's so mutable and has changed so much that I don't particularly like. I'd rather see Daniel Craig make Layer Cake again. Or whatever.
Oh, yeah.
You know, like, he came out of the same kind of movie. It's just Bond, for me, feels like the international intrigue never rings true, whereas, for whatever reason, it's so much more fantastical in Mission Impossible, but I find it more fun. I find it more like...
Well, I think they are meant to be more fun. I don't think Bond is meant to be as fun. It entered... We reinvented Bond about the same time we reinvented Batman.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's sort of the Dark Knight.
Yeah,
but
when
it's
the
not
thing
even
you did
good
was
as,
make your hero dark, and you make it a personal story about their pain.
Yeah, but it's so... Like, everything about it... It's not a good espionage drama. It's not a good action film. It's just like...
I don't know about that
one. I find
them
very compelling.
I find them very entertaining
as action
films.
I lost it a bit on Quantum of Solace. That was pretty sleepy to me, but Casino Royale I loved, and that was really lifted up for me by Eva Green, the perfect. And then Skyfall was just... It had this.
It was gorgeous.
It was gorgeous.
It was beautiful.
Sam
Mendes is a great filmmaker.
And I loved the tone of it, and I'm really looking forward to what they're going into with Spectre.
So what the Bond movies...
But I see what you mean. It's up to preference.
What the Bond movies certainly don't have, and that Mission Impossible has increasingly had,
right.
and that Angela so incisively got at in her kind of review last week.
My laser focused on one
was
romantic
like,
moment.
I like
it's like the buddy.
Review.
The buddy,
the ridiculous things in Pixels, the bromance of Mission Impossible.
That buddy dynamic between Simon Pegg and Tom Cruise.
Right, because
keeps on ticking.
It's funny because, like, I mean, I clicked onto that immediately because that's sort of where the movie launches from, but at the same time, I was like, it felt like they had been doing, like, that they had had a thing in every other movie before that, and they only... I was like going back looking at all clips. It's like, yeah, they talked in the previous movies, but it was kind of functional. Like,
right.
And
they
sort of seemed like, and then I remembered I was thinking about it. I was like, oh yeah. And every couple of interviews, somebody always asked Simon Pegg, like, so tell me about Tom Cruise, like expecting to get the like, he was a diva on set story. And he's like, he's the loveliest man.
Yeah.
Like, we have such a good
time.
You always
hear about Tom Cruise. Anyway.
And so, yeah, I don't know that anybody's even actually ever had a he was a diva on set story. But
he's
like,
just a super serious... He takes his job really seriously.
Yeah.
And takes fun very seriously.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's not like he's Clooney pulling pranks on everybody, but he's not like... He's not Christian Bale going right. super method and freaking out anytime somebody walks in front of a light.
Right. Yeah.
He brings the focus of someone who's totally clear.
Yes.
Well, yeah. I think
he has gone clear.
I think what the thing that the Mission Impossible movies have always done really well is to give you there's typically a romantic element, like that mm-hmm. gives Ethan a heart.
Yeah.
And like an attachment to the world when he could just be this born kind of character.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But it also gives you a great non-romantic relationship to focus on it. Like in the first mm-hmm. one, Ving Rhames was like the secret star.
Well, he's
of that
the other
movie.
Guy who's yeah. been in every
exactly,
one of them, right?
Yeah. People, yeah. they know that like people want to see Ving Rhames back in this role.
Yeah.
He's a hacker.
Yeah.
Ving Rhames is a hacker
people
for in five movies.
Yeah.
This is
in
amazing.
This role. And they could have cycled him out. It's like fan service at this yeah. point because what the
Ving
hell is Ving Rhames doing?
Turned one role into a lifetime of goodwill.
Yeah.
That
yeah.
does it like the he has made so many stinkers. So oh, many yeah. stinkers in the past 20, 21 years.
He takes about as many roles as Samuel L. Jackson does. He's
yeah.
just not
yeah.
as big a deal.
Yeah.
Like, he's somebody
I mean,
who will show up in... He's like Udo Kier. He's just, oh my God, you're here again. This is terrible.
Who is Udo Kier?
Udo Kier, the frightening, ominous-looking German who has...
You gotta narrow it down some.
He always has the very soft voice that's like this, and it's... almost like a sexual predator.
I know who
time.
You're talking about, but I honestly couldn't
I don't, what's
name
he been
you a movie.
In?
I couldn't name you a movie. That
Udo Kier. I
We're
mean, he was
an,
a little secret MVP of the movie Johnny Mnemonic.
Okay.
That's one of my favorite right. roles that he's been in.
You dropped Udo Kier.
Yep.
Like,
yep.
obviously, we'll just, yeah. that's shorthand and we'll just keep going.
I mean,
we all know Udo Kier
Udo
is complete
Kier is
filmography.
One of my favorite journeymen. Right. One of
journeyman
my favorite
actor.
Journeyman.
That's
German.
A 90s journeyman, too, which yeah. is,
I mean,
that's
look
a
at his filmography.
Breed.
You will see him out of the 90s.
Recently, he's gotten picked up by Lars von Trier. Lars von Trier's put him in a couple movies recently.
Oh, that's why, because I have not seen a Lars von Trier movie since... Gosh.
Breaking the Waves?
Yeah, it's been a while. Certainly not Nymphomaniac.
Yeah, but, he was in Melancholia and Nymphomaniac, so...
But with, you know, with... And now you have the Simon Pegg. Like,
yeah.
They put good... It, Will Smith and Tom Cruise... are both very good for movies in right. which the love story is not distracting.
Yeah.
And it doesn't try and shoehorn in this romantic element.
Right.
You get just, you know, you get action, you get on the surface, you get skimming, you get fun, you get mm-hmm. good, like, buddy relationships between the supporting cast.
So I think Cruise has a secret gift, and a lot of this is being the cipher that it takes to be, like, an A-list actor, right?
Sure,
and,
yeah.
and that is to be a foil to someone who knows how to be a sidekick.
Yep.
Yeah.
And
yep.
Simon Pegg knows that
build a
shit
career.
Up and
yeah.
down.
Tom Cruise yeah. knows how to share the screen.
Yeah.
In important small
yeah.
ways.
Right.
Yeah. He'll
he
give
was
that
the
up.
Star of Edge of Tomorrow.
Yeah.
Emily Blunt was the star of Edge
yeah.
of
yeah.
Tomorrow. Like, that's a Tom Cruise
he
movie.
He was the name.
Yeah.
She
yeah.
was the star.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And he's very good at that.
Yeah.
Collateral was the same way. Like, Fox was great
yeah.
in
mm-hmm.
that. And that was the first movie where I was like, oh, okay, wait a minute.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Tom Cruise can share.
But and Tom Cruise knows that like he can be funny, but like when
yeah.
he's up against Simon Pegg, like he knows exactly how to like
he's funny in the way
like,
of the guy with no personality.
Right. I'm gonna get out of the way, let Simon Pegg do his thing and just react to it perfectly.
Yeah, I'll just have
right.
my
he's
little
funny
one-liner
in the way that he's also game. I feel like still one of the best
yeah.
things
yeah.
Tom Cruise has ever done was when he did the VMAs all those years
yeah.
ago with Ben Stiller with that promo cut where Ben Stiller
oh,
was
yeah.
imitating him as he was playing the imitation of him.
Yeah.
And that's kind of like he always seems like he's up for that kind of role.
Yeah.
He'll take a jab.
And in Jack Reacher, you know, that was a Tom Cruise movie, but
yeah.
Rosamund Pike shined in that. And
yeah.
then the rest of the supporting cast was great too. He's
yeah.
for such a big deal guy for a top of the poster
I
actor.
I wanna go back to your point where like with Will Smith. I think because like they both like 5 or so years ago were both in a huge rut
yeah.
with movies, and Cruise has kind of rebuilt his career by just sort of going like a little bit more like openly comedic, I feel
mm-hmm.
like. And Will Smith has gotten a little more tightly controlled. Suicide
yeah.
Squad is really the first time where he's
yeah.
learning to loosen that grip on his career a little bit. And
mm-hmm.
I like hopefully it's a pathway to
mm-hmm.
to something a little better. And
maybe
and,
now he feels like Jaden and Willow are on their path and he can stop being like an insufferable parent. Like, Jada is free of that. Jada was, like, so far and away the best part of Gotham.
I mean, Focus was a delightful movie. If you wanted, like, a superficial caper heist movie,
how much of that is the Margot Robbie talking?
No, Margot Robbie was very good in that movie, but Will Smith was every bit the charismatic, like, usually funny, like,
right.
putting his body on the line for, like, you know, a joke. And it was slick, it was sexy, it had the great, like, compatriot relationship with, like, the surprising co-stars that you get from a Tom Cruise or Will Smith movie. Yes, Margot Robbie is arresting, but that's a true fact about Margot Robbie. That's why she's having a moment.
Right.
That's why she's
cast.
Yeah, I'm not, like, spewing the gospel of Margot Robbie. This, you know, young would-be star that no one's heard of her is not going to get cast in any films.
Yeah.
I'm just responding to what Hollywood already knows.
I still can't really get over the fact that it was supposed to be Kristen Stewart, and then once Will Smith got cast,
she was like,
as Harley Quinn or in Focus?
No, in Focus. They cast Kristen Stewart, and then they cast Will Smith, and she was like, he's a little too old. I'm in a piece.
Yeah. She makes good role selection, Kristen Stewart.
She
knows her zone.
Yeah.
She plays in it.
She got her bones on the Twilight series and then has now turned to a great
I don't know if her zone is a zone that on-screen chemistry is a part of. Like, that is not her lane
she
to me
She kind
at
of,
all.
But it, but
I know, but
yes,
she does. Look at those
she
trailers
does.
With Kristen Jesse
Stewart,
Eisenberg.
Kristen Stewart has an, it's weird to say, but she has an anti-chemistry appeal.
Yeah.
Like, honestly. Like, as weird as Adventureland was, and as much, repressed homosexual girl, which is why you're having a weird time hitting it off with Jesse Eisenberg.
Right.
But, like, and Clouds of Sils Maria.
Yeah, that was really funny because, like, they were not having chemistry because they were, like, actress and assistant. But that was, like, the most charged thing.
But the subtext chemistry was that entire movie.
Yeah.
Who's the assistant?
She's the assistant
to
Julia Ormond.
Yeah.
Oh.
And she does just uncomfortably, like, magnetic simmering.
Mm-hmm.
Better than probably anybody.
Anybody
it's very
ever
specific.
Has.
Tortured defense of Kristen Stewart.
No, I don't think it's a tortured defense at all. I fully endorse Kristen Stewart. And I think she picks great for her to say, he's actually a little too old for me. Like, after seeing what Margot Robbie did with that role, Margot Robbie is the kind of performer that you needed in that spot.
Right.
Yeah.
Kristen Stewart would have been shoehorn all the way.
Yeah.
And then she realized and was like, whoa, no. Like, Kristen Stewart has to be a character that for a time is bottled so deeply inside before she can somehow express on screen to fully make use of her particular abilities, which anytime Kristen Stewart gets cast in something, I think she did the job that you want Kristen Stewart to do.
Yeah.
She's like a not action Michelle Rodriguez.
Yeah.
You only cast Michelle Rodriguez to play a version of Michelle Rodriguez.
Right. Yeah.
You
right.
only cast K2 to play a version of K2.
Right.
Great. You only cast Denzel to play a version of Denzel. Like, there are niche actors that play a part of themselves on screen, and I want to see them.
Yeah.
I want to see them in the
even
right
in Still Alice when she's just the sort of. She's not quite put upon daughter,
she's
but she's
bit,
like
a little bit of the malcontent.
Yeah, she's the the finding her way still daughter of the bunch.
She's the one who it appears like needs her mother's presence more than the other siblings at that particular time.
But then she comes in that great monologue at the end, and
Kevin Spacey
just in
always
tears.
Plays Kevin Spacey. He plays varying versions of how smug Kevin Spacey may or may not be.
Yeah,
and
or may not. Very generous.
Yeah, like I can't say, but like there's always like if you want 50 Shades of Smug, you cast Kevin Spacey in a role, and he does a great job for it. But like. The only difference between Frank Underwood and, like, the killer in Seven, spoiler, is the accent. Like,
what's in the box?
Yeah, like, that's, like, the temperament and, like, the demeanor.
Yeah.
He might as well have been whipping votes in Congress in Seven.
Yeah.
But, like that, it's the same thing.
Right. The entire car drive monologue in Seven isn't that much different than his two-camera, Frank Underwood moments.
Yeah, I'm not going to chide actors for being, like, these hired hitmen in, like, the one very specific way. Yeah.
We started at Rogue Nation, and we ended at... Spacey is basically Kristen Stewart.
We turned it into a Rogue Nation.
We've gone unimaginably far afield.
We have gone rogue.
Yep. Totally, totally rogue. Let's reel it back in.
Yeah.
This weekend.
Yeah.
In the theaters, which you may or may not patronize, we got Fantastic Four coming. Reviews are just starting to come out, despite 20th Century Fox's best efforts.
Are people breaking embargoes?
Not breaking embargoes. It's just if they had their way, no one would have reviewed this movie. It is the thing where most of the screenings are on a Wednesday, and then you pop the review on a Thursday. They're not great. Not great. We'll get into it a bit more next week, but early word.
I feel like the floor should be yours on this because, like, I'm pretty negative on Fantastic Four, but you seem to be the advocate for, like, they can do a Fantastic Four
story. They could do a Fantastic Four story. What a great group of heroes it is.
I don't know how you couldn't do a good movie about the original Marvel heroes. Like,
sure.
Right.
I mean, it was their original team. Like, that was, they got the stories, right?
But they predated everyone as a team.
Where one storm gives four different people different powers. Sure.
And it's a comic book.
Yeah, I know. If we're nitpicking here, but like, I don't know. The people who say it's like, maybe we should just sort of let this one be in the comics. We've had three cracks at it.
But that's
now.
Because people insist on doing origin stories.
Right.
Like, the second Alba, Chris Evans, Fantastic
Rise of
Four,
Silver Surfer.
At least had Silver Surfer in it. It was a terrible movie.
Yeah.
Silver Surfer was super cool.
Yeah.
They called a cloud Galactus.
Yes, right. So there were problems, but the world of the Fantastic Four, you have Galactus, you have Silver Surfer, you have the Negative Zone. You have a bridge from Marvel's superhero world into the, like, space world and the crazy mystic world. It should be the bridge that allows Doctor Strange and Guardians and whoever to all, I mean, they're going to do it with Infinity War, but Fantastic Four, granted, Marvel Studios doesn't own them. That's why all this crazy shit is happening on the fringes. But like, Doctor Doom, also great fucking villain.
Yeah.
How can you tell me this should stay in the comic books? This should be one of the best superhero movie properties there is. They can't do it.
As long as you don't cast the dude from Nip Tuck as Doctor Doom.
Is that who it is?
Julian did a great job. What was it? Oh, I forget his name. Monahan? Monaghan?
Oh, in Nip Tuck?
Yeah, he played Julian
in the first.
You're the one dragging us afield, McFarland.
It's true.
I'm just 12-year-old resume hits. That has no place here.
No, it's weird. It's weird. I mean, the fact that they can make, it's not like Fantastic Four doesn't have any more viability than some of the other batshit properties that have been successfully brought to screen. Like, you just need the right people, and they didn't have them, I guess.
Right. So the difference here is what? It's Fox, which has had a tougher time bringing some characters to life.
Right.
You know, when we're taping this now, Deadpool Red Band has not premiered officially, though it did on Conan last night. But we've seen the teaser, and we can already tell they're doing that in the right way.
Yeah.
This has anticipation. They know the tone. They know the notes. Something about this Fantastic Four, it wasn't the screenwriter. Simon Kinberg has had a lot to do with X-Men in its recent incarnations and is doing a great job guiding that story. We don't know if it's Josh Trank who directed it, and it was like rumor had it was a plagued production, mostly by his inability to be ready for that scale of movie after doing like one smaller budget movie.
Yeah.
No. But like, I don't know.
Right.
Where's the problem?
The cast is good.
The cast is kind of good.
I mean, Michael B. Jordan.
Michael B. Jordan is great, but no one else who was in that movie. My purposes,
not a Miles Teller guy.
It's not that I don't like Kate Mara, or Miles Teller, or Jamie Bell. Sorry. But none of those people feel like the right move for the character. Michael B. Jordan, I was like, he's going to be great. Mm-hmm. I totally get him as Johnny Storm. I don't see any of the other three as their person,
curiosity, how did you feel about Ion Gafford as Mr. Fantastic before? Did he feel good to you?
No, he was nothing to me. I think you can cast a mild-mannered scientist really well, and they just haven't done it right.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
That guy had the charisma of seriously a piece of drywall.
It was toast.
Miles
Teller isn't much better, but that's not his fault.
Right.
He can be charismatic.
Yeah, totally.
It takes a very special person to connect to Reed Richards, who is what?
Right.
He's a stretchy scientist. Stretchy. Someone can do that. Someone needs the comedy and someone, I don't know.
Should Marvel just like throw down at the negotiating table and just Marvel and Disney just throw down a ton of cash to get these properties back?
Fox is never going to give it up. As long as they have X-Men, which does well, they're going to keep their universe.
Yeah.
All right.
Is that something that, do we think that this is something that Marvel sits around and they're like, God, we just need to get it out of their hand? Or do they...
I think they gave
up. About it?
Okay. I don't know. It's hard to say. Like, look, they basically stopped doing a new Fantastic Four series. They're like, fine, we're going to shut this down. You don't get our stories.
Right.
You can do this yourselves.
Okay. Yeah.
There is a sequel with a release date for Fantastic Four 2. What's going to happen? I mean, look, we don't know what's going to happen at the box office.
Nope.
We'll talk about that next week. But I want a Fantastic Four movie to be really good. I want a good Fantastic Four movie more than I wanted a good Iron Man movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But what was different is they found Iron Man. Mm-hmm. They found Tony Stark.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
They haven't found three of the Fantastic Four.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Do you think there's one that is the linchpin around which the others can grow?
You can make it around any of them but Reed.
Okay. Okay.
You could, yeah. I mean, it really could be. Any of the three could become the emotional focal point of a Fantastic Four movie, as far as I'm concerned. Because they all have stuff going on. I mean, I think that Ben Grimm is awesome to do it with. He's one of the few Jewish heroes. He has, like, intimacy issues writ large. There's a lot going on there.
This is way afield of that, but Peter, I'll ask because you're more of an expert on this. Is it, you know, like, one of the problems is always, like, stop with origin stories, like, that's already kind of hard. But
I was just screaming about that earlier today.
Yeah, yeah, but I mean, is it also just, like, trying to introduce four people at the same time, like at least with like Avengers, right. Like we started with Iron Man and then we got some Thor and then like we kind of brought it together. Is this just like trying to launch too much at people? But no, they did it
Guardians
with X-Men.
The,
and
Guardians
it,
of the Galaxy worked.
Yeah. Guardians worked because...
You knew even less
but
about
you
them.
Yeah, you needed to know names.
Yeah.
You kind of get that this guy made rocks... can do some things, and this guy sets on fire, and he's stretchy, and she's invisible. Okay,
yeah.
We can start like the Incredibles did in media res, and that, pretty much figure out what all these people
that
can
is
do.
Basically yeah. your template for a Fantastic
that,
Four. Yeah,
that is exactly what I'm saying. They can do a Fantastic Four movie. It's just voiced by Craig T.
Nelson. It's called the Incredibles.
By Brad Bird. Speaking of Brad Bird to the rescue,
man, it can happen. I feel like people had it in for the... Look, again, we're taking way too much time talking about Fantastic Four this week because it's not out yet.
But I like these as jumping off points because I think these are valid points for the greater superhero development universe that you're making.
Right.
Yeah, I'm glad we are getting into it. It doesn't feel right. like too much of a distraction.
And just to be clear, I'm not... In no way am I like a Fantastic Four in the comics expert. I just like have always had... an attachment to that team the way a lot of people do to Spider-Man, and I never did.
Right.
Spider-Man was always super boring to me, but Fantastic Four was fucking awesome.
Mm-hmm. To Kevin's point about what, you know, does Marvel just need to throw down a bunch of cash to get the Fantastic Four back? I wonder if they ever could... Fox probably won't let them, but let them do what they're doing with Spider-Man now and Sony, which is like...
Some
it's still
kind of
there.
I mean, maybe after like, this movie that they're going to be like...
It's their only play.
Paul.
Yeah.
Paul, it's... It's Fox.
Yeah.
We have a favor to ask you. It has to do with you saving our asses.
Right.
You don't get Deadpool, though.
Yeah.
Hold on to Deadpool, guys.
That's the one thing we're not going to let go.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's a lot of movie time. Thankfully.
Right, we can switch from the anger and vitriol over the handling of a Fantastic Four franchise into something a little bit happier.
An even better super team.
Guys, I'm just Peter's
joyful time.
I'm walking on air. I've been walking on air for the past few days.
That's great.
And it's because of a little thing called Wet Hot American Summer First Day of Camp.
Woohoo.
Oh.
As soon as this was announced, as people who know me or work with me can attest to, I was like, they're doing a what?
Yeah.
They're doing a what?
Yeah.
It's, you know, I am, if I have any fanboy in me that is left over from being reserved for Dave Chappelle, it is reserved for the state and everything that they've done over time. Like, since that MTV show, they have, like, built and built and built, and they always work with each other, and the original Wet Hot was a standby for me for, well, more than a decade.
Yeah.
And so the idea of a prequel series was fraught with, like, it's going to be so easy to screw this up, but I was ready for
but
it.
But also maybe the best possible idea they could have had for doing
best it. Possible.
Yeah.
Which makes the possibility of heartbreak even more heartbreaking.
Yeah. So if you have not seen the original 2000 movie, maybe 2001? 2001 movie, it takes place on the last day of camp at an overnight summer camp in Maine. And it stars Michael Showalter and Paul Rudd and Elizabeth Banks and Ken Marino and Joe Latruglio and David Hyde Pierce and Chris Maloney and Molly Shannon, and I can just keep going. A lot of people. A very early Bradley Cooper.
Yeah.
A very early Amy Poehler.
Pre-Saturday Night Live.
Was it pre-SNL?
Yeah, it was just before she got cast. Yeah.
A lot of good people, and it has become, as I learned from Kevin, it was a movie that people would go watch because... people knew this movie as being like ground zero for all of these crazy comedy stars.
That was kind of how I first experienced it. It was, whoa, this cast list is incredible. How are all of these people in this one movie together?
Yep. Yeah.
And so what they decided to do for a Netflix show was to set it the same summer, but rather than doing it on the last day of camp, to do it on the first day of camp. So it is an 8-episode series that takes place on the first day of camp, with all the people playing themselves 2 months younger, or when in reality they are 15 full years older. A lot of people have not changed at all.
It's amazing.
Yeah. At all.
Elizabeth Banks?
Elizabeth Banks is way better 15 years older than she was. Like, just a more confident performer, more attractive. That's not a filter, but she plays like a sex pot kind of character.
Sure.
Yeah.
And Paul Rudd is a carbon copy.
Paul Rudd is a carbon copy, and Marguerite Moreau is essentially a carbon copy.
Yeah.
Janine Garofalo has done some things to her face, but comedically it looks the same person.
Yeah.
A lot of people have had some things change. Yeah. Michael Showalter, for all the talk about Charlize Theron's bravery in the movie Monster, Michael Showalter has aged 15 years.
Only?
Only. He's a bigger man than he was 15 years ago when he was like 27 waist, slim cut denim in the original movie.
Sure.
He's a big dude now.
Okay, so
are
we sure this isn't a Fat Mac from It's Always Sunny
situation?
Well,
I haven't confirmed this, but okay. I was, from the moment my wife and I started watching, I was like, is this really all Showalter? Because I met him maybe 5 years ago, and he was halfway between.
Okay.
He wasn't, he was rail thin in Wet Hot American Summer.
Yeah, rail, for sure.
He was like, they were like 20, no, they must have been late 20s, around 30 when they did it, because they're all in their probably mid-40s now.
Mm-hmm.
He is, everyone else, you grow and you spread you mature and your body isn't the same. Things happen. And I'm dwelling on this only because it's kind of such a shock when you meet him, but he sinks into it with such, like, comedy confidence and wears just such horrifically, hilariously unflattering things. And one of the best subplots of this is that his girlfriend from last year is Lake Bell. And she keeps giving him these douchey accoutrements
so ridiculous
to wear. From a puka shell necklace to a ridiculous hat to a dangly earring, and as the show goes on, he just becomes more and more like a early 80s rock douchebag. But overall, Kevin and I were talking while we were watching this separately with a couple of other people, and it took you a minute to get in.
It took me like 4 episodes. Like, I got 4 episodes in and was kind of like, what am I even...
Faster than True Detective.
Yeah, what can I... Yeah.
There was a lot at the beginning about just establishing its rhythm. Mm-hmm. And it's not joke.
Right.
Around halfway through the third episode, things started paying off, and it started being much more consciously fan servicey to me. Like, all these ties started getting introduced.
Well, it was being surreal in a way that it felt of a piece with the movie, but also satisfying people who knew the movie well enough to catch tiny details
and
in it.
And we've been all day we've been talking about
going back and forth on these little things, where I feel like the more times you rewatch it, the more little tiny things you're going to notice, the little connections that you're going
to
find.
That seems like the best possible way to fill 8 hours worth of time.
Right.
Like, that seems like the smart play.
Four episodes, 4 hours worth of time.
That seems like the smart play of just, like you said, like if it starts like 3 episodes and then things start to pay off, like, use that build.
It's such stark contrast to Arrested Development, which had probably greater anticipation just because more people watched the original show. And they also did something kind of conceptually a little daring in doing the kind of interlacing storylines and the POV episodes.
Mm-hmm.
But I wasn't alone in feeling that it was a little unsatisfying and it didn't quite have the same rhythms. Whereas there are sequences in First Day of Camp that build on the exact same dynamic between people sharing a scene in the movie. Mm-hmm. And, like, as Jordan, I'm sure you won't be surprised to know, Joe Latrullo turns in and Ken Marino together. It takes them, they don't really come into play prominently until probably the 7th episode
of 8. Yeah.
But then you get that scene with them that is like those scenes in the movie. And God, Zach Orth is just, everyone
does.
He's got
some better moments than he did in the movie. And that's
the
thing.
He had some of the better ones in the movie too, though.
Well, you get, I don't think they're, I guess what I would say is by 4 episodes in, I was worried that it was an Arrested Development season 4 situation. Mm-hmm. And then after like watching the back half of it and then watching it again to sort of get more detail, I'm totally on board with what they did. But I still feel like the movie has higher peaks than
it does.
Yeah, like I mean,
the montage of going into town.
Yeah, that's really the one that I would say. Like that is the best moment in that movie to me. And
oh, it's one of
one of many. But like it's hard to choose. But I think that sequence is just so utterly brilliant in like 2 minutes. It's a classic Funny or Die sketch now.
Yeah.
That is just plopped into that movie and works perfectly.
But that's the comedy that they like pioneered in so many ways. Like
much.
There was this thing happening. You know, a lot of people point to Mr. Show as well. They should, and they're the granddaddies, right? There's SCTV, and then there's early SNL, and then in the 90s you had Mr. Show, and you had The State. The State actually started a couple years before Mr. Show, and I would argue heralded that rise of kind of alt comedy in sketch.
Sure.
Even before, like they did the same kind of Monty Python conceptual ties between sketches. But they all work so well together. Yeah. And the new cast additions for the Netflix series, on top of everyone from the old one, Lake Bell's around, Chris Pine, Jordan Peele, there's one big one that I'm missing.
Well, there's John Slattery.
John Hamm.
Jason Schwartzman.
So the thing that surprised me about the Netflix is how much time is given to the, like, let's put on a show aspect of the camp musical, which is all staged on the first day of camp.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But we spend more time in rehearsals for this musical than in anything else in the entire series.
Yeah, not in the art room, not out at the...
barely ever in the art room.
Yeah.
Barely ever in the art room. And you're not on any other trips with people. But Amy Poehler and Bradley Cooper and Michael Ian Black get their time to shine.
Give you like the backstory that you didn't know that you were dreaming of for Bradley Cooper and Michael Ian Black.
And it's
like,
so there are just two little moments that I want to point to as like that let you know how much they tied these things together. Is I went back and watched the movie last night because it had been probably 6 weeks since I'd seen it.
Like I watched it on 4th
of July. Long time.
Exactly. So at one point, there's David Hyde Pierce plays this astrophysicist who meets the camp director, played by Janine Garofalo, and there's this flirtation going on. And in the movie, she's like, oh, but you're such a, like, something about tenure isn't guaranteed or he's not publishing enough. And she's like, but you're such a brilliant astrophysicist. And he says, yeah, tell it to my dean. Which, after you've seen the Netflix show and there's this incredible tirade at the dean, Richard Schiff, a great Richard Schiff performance. And a great Rob Hubel performance, too. God,
it's
chock full of great people. But it's just like that line in the movie resonates so much more strongly now that the later prequel series has kind of done a little groundwork to that.
Yeah. Right.
And then the four or five like loser campers who spend the day with David Hyde Pierce learning about Space Lab or trying to avert Space Lab are recast in the prequel series in a way that you would not even think about them. And it wasn't until I went and rewatched the movie and I was like, wait a minute. And I went and I screenshotted a bunch of stuff to prove to myself that it was real. It's such a great reuse of the same cast. And also, there's this kid in First Day of Camp.
Drew?
This kid, he plays a redheaded kid named Drew who calls himself
the bully.
He's the burp king of Westchester.
Oh, God.
He's a dream. He is a comedy dream. He kills that every scene he's in.
He's just the perfect villain.
He's the perfect, like, 12-year-old bully. Oh, God. I'm sorry. I'm just...
He unleashes a couple just perfect vulgar tirades. Yeah. Like, not quite David Hyde Pierce level. Like,
nothing
perfect.
Can match that one thing David Hyde Pierce says. And it's only been out for 3 days. I don't want to spoil it and quote stuff, but I will be on my Twitter feed perpetuity.
I still get the feeling like it's just going to be floating around and it will be as highly quotable.
Oh, yeah.
As the movie was.
I think so. Yeah. I'm really excited about you guys getting a chance.
Yeah, I'm only like an episode and a half in. And yeah. I was the one thing that for some reason keeps sticking in my mind is like, I'm so excited to see where the beekeeper goes. That kid, the DJ kid.
Beekeeper, they cast a kid with a velvet voice.
I was like, how did they find that kid? Because the original beekeeper's got to be in his late 20s now or something.
Well,
right?
So it's the same kid, but it's still Sam Levine doing the voice. That's the thing.
He's doing the voice only in the non-camera on him voiceovers. When the beekeeper is on the mic, he's still the beekeeper. Just like the beekeeper on camera in the movie has a voice, but then Sam Levine is doing the...
Huh.
wait a minute.
I think it
Sam
is Sam Levine
because
David Wayne, yeah,
in the show?
Yeah, because Sam Levine, because David Wayne said this, basically he like knew Sam Levine from, like, because he had just been in, like, in Freaks and Geeks and stuff. He was still
they
pretty
young. They
were
kind young. Of simultaneous. Yeah,
yeah, but he basically, like, David Wayne went to Sam Levine and was like, hey, so the dialogue for this kid, like, isn't recorded well, like, because of the way they shot it, like, the dialogue just didn't work, so he needed somebody to do voiceover work. It wasn't, like, a purposeful comedic thing that they had a different voice. So I think when they cast a kid to look like the beekeeper kid and then just did Sam Levine's voice again.
But they're on the kid a lot. He talks a lot in the show.
Yeah, but just watching it, I think it's pretty. I think all of it's ADR with.
Oh my
with
God!
Sam
my mind has just been completely blown. I'm gonna go back and see if that really is. If I missed a Sam Levine reprisal. There will be reprisals.
We'll check the IMDb. Look, put it in the show notes.
I don't trust that. Yep. I don't trust IMDb in the Sam Levine voice ID game. We're going to the
tape. Yeah, we're going to the tape. We'll get
we're
that.
Playing War Rules we'll with this one. Oh, man. What else is going on? I just filibustered my way through that one. I apologize.
I make it a habit of doing that at some point every episode, so I can hardly blame you.
Feeling pretty optimistic.
No, that's great. You've been waiting for this for so long. The time you spent was commensurate with the intensity with which you were anticipating the show.
Yeah.
There are a lot of good moments.
A lot I look of good moments. Really forward to watching them unfold.
Man, that's all.
Speaking of getting of something you've been waiting for.
Yeah, what's up?
Still waiting on a Frank Ocean record.
Still waiting on Boys Don't Cry.
I've heard that it's soon.
It's soon. His FrankOcean.com, not his Tumblr, but FrankOcean.com redirects to BoysDon'tCry.co.
Okay.
Isn't that right?
That's a start.
And that even that site had mutated a little bit over the course of Monday. So if you're, it's possible that when you're listening to this on Wednesday, that album has dropped.
Yeah. I just don't subscribe to the, where the album at? Because just give them the time.
Yeah.
Like, you know how long we said, where's the album at? With Justin Timberlake?
Why'd you give us an album? It's been done. He's shown picture, like.
But the music industry is so opaque. This shit comes
Frank
out when it comes
Ocean
out.
Ocean cares
like,
not for your record
he
industry.
He cares. He also cares not for your anticipation.
That's true.
So, like he cares as much for your anticipation. The man is an artist.
Yes.
The man is an artist. Yeah. Your goddamn album.
I'm happy to give him all the time on earth, but he had just said July, and this is the first episode that we're doing in August.
And how long have we been waiting on TBD name Kanye
Surf
album
took
theoretically
a very long
Swish?
Time.
Yeah. Or Detox, which is no longer Detox.
Yeah, everybody says
we gotta talk about that.
Yeah. Everybody says something's coming at some time and like if you're Beyonce, you just don't tell people and you do it. If you're Taylor Swift, you plan like a 4-month PR blitz and then you do it. Like you just everybody else is just like, you get your album when you get your album.
Yeah.
But
artists have a tough time not saying coming soon or dropping this month and that was Social Experiment. Yeah. We've been expecting Surf for 6 months.
Yeah.
I'm waiting for Ephes with the Janelle Monáe crowd, Team Wonderland, forever, but, like, I'm not curious about when it's coming anymore because the thing will show up when it
just
shows up.
Just listen to Classic Man on repeat. You'll be fine.
Yeah. There's so much new music every day.
It's true.
Frank Ocean, if you're not going to give me what I want, then kind of screw you today. I'm going to go, play Donnie Trumpet again. I'm going to go find something new that I haven't listened to because you're not giving me what I want. So you don't deserve my words.
Speaking of, I want to give a shout because we talk about Surf a lot. And Jordan, now that you're super into the album,
I want to
recommend an album from 2011 that is by the Stepkids,
okay,
who was a group that they do a lot of work on Surf. And so the singing on She Had Some Vibes For Me, I had no clue. So that's Stepkids, who were signed to Stone's Throw, trio out of Connecticut, I think, really like just multi-instrumentalist kind of jazz soul, like very modern day Hall & Oatesy to me.
Wow.
But it's such a great album. And I'm glad to see them featured so prominently on an album that I like so much of now. Just because, like, between that, they've done some stuff between that first self-titled album and now that hasn't resonated with me as much, but I love their presence on Surf.
I just get such a thrill out of seeing these great collaborative efforts of these artists that on their own do great work and they're like, let's just come together and make something really pretty.
Yeah.
Like, we've been talking a lot about Thundercat in the office lately around some stuff we've been doing, and Eric Stoyer's been talking about it, and to hear about how he was was involved with the Kendrick Lamar album, and he autonomously is such a big deal. It's just so outstanding.
That just reminded me of something, which was the video that Kendrick just recently dropped for Free, which is that interlude early on the album, mm-hmm. into Pimp a Butterfly.
Yeah.
This dude will not stop pushing limits, and I love it. It's the kind of thing that you're like, this won't be a single, and it certainly won't be a video, because this shit is just way too on the edge to put like the audio visual machine behind, and he did it, and it's fucking incredible.
When did this come out?
Yeah, I was gonna say
it came out on Friday.
Look for it in your music video roundup.
Yeah, kind of a stealth drop, but it's just. My man is...
I want to get out of the booth so I can watch this now.
I mean, just hip-hop is in such good hands between Chance and Kendrick. Yeah. And then that brings us to the thing, Kevin, that you brought up, which was
Compton,
on Friday. Was it Friday or Saturday that Dre's Beach One show...
I think it might have been over the weekend.
Yeah, I think it was Saturday.
So it's called The Pharmacy, and they do it like whenever Dre has something to talk about or whatever on Beats One. So it's a round table interview, and Dre was there, and F. Gary Gray was there, who directed Straight Outta Compton. And Dre just kind of offhandedly mentions that, oh, he's got an album and it's coming out next week, and it's called Compton the Soundtrack.
This
and
is how the music industry works.
And everyone was like, wait, what? What the fuck? Because Detox, which was the album that dude had been working on since before the Chronic 2001, people had been waiting for 15 years. Dre was like, yeah, we did it. I didn't really like it. So instead, here's an entirely new album, and Ice Cube shows up, and Kendrick shows up, and it's a bunch of rappers old and new. Mm-hmm. And wow.
It's coming this week, right?
It's hitting Apple Music on Friday.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
And it's for sale on Saturday? Is that possible?
Sounds right.
I feel like there's a preview on Friday on
maybe they're gonna stream it or something.
I really love that in the same year Kendrick Lamar shows up on a Dre album and Taylor Swift songs.
Yeah. And Jidenna and Imagine Dragons and
then makes these music videos that are just so wondrous and surprising and beautiful.
Like it's
honestly, Kendrick Lamar.
What a multi-hyphenate wonderful.
He's a fucking national treasure. Like, straight up, this dude needs to be
Ellen
enshrined.
DeGeneres completely agrees with you.
I'm glad to hear that.
She loves
And I love,
Kendrick
too,
Kendrick
that
more.
This dude is touching... Like, he was such a rapper's rapper.
Yeah.
Right? There was no reason that Ellen DeGeneres would be up on the stuff he was doing. And then he signed with a major, and everyone's like, yeah, we'll see. People sign with Dre, and then they never come out.
Right.
And then he did, and it was a great album, and it was a concept album, and then he fucked around and made another one that's twice as complex. It's just...
He's unstoppable.
Juggernaut. Unstoppable. Juggernaut status.
Yeah.
Anyway, Compton, the soundtrack, is dropping on Friday. We'll see.
We'll see. Yeah, we will see. That's the thing. We'll see.
Dre's vaults. I can't even imagine how much music is in there.
It's got to be like Prince. It's just got to be like albums and albums.
And albums from rappers that got signed and never came out.
I know. A studio with a wall full of plaques.
Eve's album on Aftermath. Bishop Lamont's album on Aftermath. Busta's came out. Busta Rhymes did come out, didn't it? The Aftermath one that he did? Yeah, it did.
Yeah.
Big Bang.
Yeah.
But so many people signed with Aftermath over the years and would record and record and record, and nothing would ever happen. He's sitting on all of that in his mansion. Or somewhere.
In it's all full of tracks in addition to that wall full of plaques.
That's true. I mean, how many, he told us. Right.
It's true.
How many Eminem tracks does he have that he has never released?
That's a good question. Because M records so much in Michigan now.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know... And he's the kind of guy who would have ownership of his stuff at this point, and he works with so many other people.
Yeah.
Dre was an incubator.
Mm-hmm.
Like, Dre recorded, like, all the G-Unit stuff that you never heard.
Yeah, that's right.
Like, all the people that would sign deals with G-Unit, Mobb Deep's album, Bobby Creekwater, Cassius, people that you may have never heard of.
I remember Cassius. I can't say I remember Bobby Creekwater.
Bobby Creekwater.
What a
Bobby
name.
Bobby Creekwater's still waiting for that Death Row album to come out.
My brain is full of rap trivia. But Frank Ocean, man, please do come out. It's time. There is and I hope that the New York Times Magazine feature on Weekend maybe spurs him to drop this, just because it's so lionizing and like it talks about the rise of darker, more challenging R&B, and it name checks the same people that everyone name checks, Miguel and whoever.
Yeah, Miguel's got his album out. Weekends is out at the end of August, and then
it's a good time.
Ocean's got his. It's in the can.
Well, it's interesting talking about like the rise of darker, edgier R&B. It's like The Weeknd is known as darker, more edgier R&B, but then like Can't Feel My Face is not.
Right.
Is The Weeknd darker, more edgier R&B?
Right. Well, that's kind of the thrust of the profile, which John Caramonica does as well as he always does. But it's kind of about how, so Weeknd makes Kiss Land and it sells less than 300,000, and he goes to Wendy Goldstein, who was like the head of Republic Records at the time, and he was like, I want to be big. She was like, you want to be biggest in the world? He's like, yeah. She's like, okay. So she hooks him up with Max Martin.
Yeah.
Right?
Boom. There.
Well, yes and no, right? Because Max Martin would like write songs for people and then be like, sing this. So Weeknd looks at it and he's like, yeah, I don't know. He rewrites some lyrics, and Max Martin is like, oh, wait, no, I like this. Let's do it this way. Yeah. So the Weeknd managed to put his bleak, horrific, dystopian spin on upbeat chart toppers.
I respect somebody's desire to go huge. Go top 40.
Yeah.
Love it.
But it still has that kind of makes Peter so sad when he listens to it because Weeknd sounds so sad.
Yeah.
I mean, Weeknd looks so sad. Like,
I'm not sure I've ever seen him smile.
He's always like has that downturned gaze. And that was what was so weird about seeing him perform with Ariana Grande. It was like, there are two styles at work here.
Right.
Never the twain really meet.
Just seeing his face for the first time, I mean, he was so...
Yeah, he was a mystery.
Behind the curtain for so long.
I had music video dance machine.
Visions of what that guy... I was like, what could this guy possibly
look no
like?
One knew.
Could
no
you
one
have
one
conceived knew of the hair?
No. And the hair changed even in the time from when he first showed his face until now.
It's grown and grown.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's got that hair grows. Bob look to it. Great.
Except just two main.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, those are sentient. They are.
Yeah.
They move. They feel.
He did. I would have to take that back. I've seen him smile. He did an unplugged version of Love Me Harder with Ariana Grande where he was very happy. Was like smiling. I don't know. It's a weird unplugged video.
It's the creepiest time to be
happy. It's a weird unplugged video, but he's just happy in it.
You leave Ariana Grande alone. Get away from her.
Apparently. God, it's not the place to discuss celebrity relationships, but he is apparently involved with
and Bella. I'm not bringing it up.
Bella Hadid?
Oh, model? Bella, yeah.
Wait, that's who Weeknd's did?
Yeah.
Abel's dating?
Or that they are, nothing is confirmed, but the profile makes
the Hadids conspicuous are just notice having of her their presence. Moment in 2015. The Hadids are owning 2015.
Man.
You heard it here first, apparently.
But no, that Gigi.
Ownership of 2015. Awarded to the Hadids.
Gigi is blowing up on the scene. She's having a big model year. She's dating Joe Jonas.
Dude, Model Watch. Jordan Cruciola is
I'm
Model
always
Watch.
On Model Watch.
You are
I'm
a Model Watch.
That's how we should end every podcast.
Not only
Model Watch.
Was Bella Hadid brought to my attention, but now I know that there are not one, but multiple Hadids.
Well, and then their brother Anwar is a beautiful young man, and then there's a third sister in there, too.
There's a whole
She gets 2016.
Dad is Palestinian. Mom's, I think it was a Dutch model. So
there you go.
Do that mental beauty math in your mind.
They Hadid it their way.
On
that horrific off-key note, we're going to call it a day here at the Monitor. We'll be back next week to talk about the actual particulars of Fantastic Four and what made it either surprisingly palatable or as bad as everyone said. Mm. But we didn't get to talk about the Unreal finale. That's cool. We'll get at that another time. What else is going on in the upcoming week that we need to think about? There's the Deadpool Red Band trailer, which we can talk about in more detail.
Yeah. Ricky and the Flash.
Oh, Ricky and the Flash.
I'm psyched.
And we'll, I'm sure, have thoughts on the then will be upcoming Straight Outta Compton and Man from U.N.C.L.E.
True Detective finale
is going to be my
90 minutes.
The Vikander beat also.
The Vikander beat is loud in my heart.
Yeah. All right, all this crosstalk is gonna come to a close now. We thank you guys for joining us, and we'll see you next week.
We're not signing off.
Oh, we'll sign off. Sign off, Model Watch.
Model Watch signing off. This is Jordan Cruciola. Find me, I guess, anywhere that's relevant at JorCrew, and get out there and look for that Vanity Fair with Taylor Swift on the cover, hitting stands soon. Photos by Mario Testino. You're gonna love it.
I am Angela Watercutter. You can find me on Twitters at Waterslicer, WaterSlicer. And you can also find me last weekend at a barn dance. which yeah. I promised I was going to get into the podcast.
Story. Oh, let your mind wander about that.
Yeah. Hold on. I did not know there was a barn dance story. Please, the rest of you, except Angela, remind me to ask Angela the barn dance story next week on a live mic. I don't want to waste it. I don't want to waste it hearing about it off mic. I want to hear about it on record.
Me and Angela will talk about the barn dance.
All
next
right,
week.
Barn yes. dance watch coming at you.
Bathed in the blue moonlight.
KMF gonna rock
and
you.
And I am Kevin McFarland. You can find me on Twitter at KM underscore McFarland, McFarland.
He was hoping we'd forget. He's also known as Lil Kev.
King of the turn up.
AKA Knox McGillicuddy.
Knox McGillicuddy.
Lil Kev.
And Lil Kev.
Nikki Pizzolatto salutes you, Knox McGillicuddy.
Can't top any of these. I'll just give my government name, and that's Peter Rubin. You can find me on the internet, usually on Twitter at Proven Self. That's PROVENSELF for the rest of the crew. I want to thank you for tuning in, and we'll see you guys next week.